we're talking about the news this week that Milwaukee got the winning bid to host the 2020 Democratic National Convention. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 50,000 people are expected to descend on Milwaukee, and we're going to learn about the political significance of the DNC's choice here to hold the convention in Wisconsin's largest city and the message it sends. We're at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this news? Let us know. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's a professor of law and public policy. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com, founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So Milwaukee will be one of the smallest cities to host a presidential convention. What do you think the decision to go with a smaller city signals about, you know, what Democrats are thinking on 2020?
I think it highlights that this is a very deliberate choice by the party to come here. You know, our competitors were Houston and Miami, and those are much larger cities. And the convention, either party's convention, has never been held in Milwaukee over the period since the parties existed. So this is a choice between two large cities that host lots of conventions and are in somewhat competitive states, or to come here. I think the choice here then emphasizes that this is a decision that reflects the party's commitment to Wisconsin and to the Midwest states in the upcoming election.
Well, what does that look like a little bit? What does Milwaukee say about what the DNC is thinking right now, or perhaps as it weaves together as we head into this next presidential election?
I think the primary message is we won't ignore you again. Famously, Hillary Clinton did not campaign in Wisconsin in 2016 and lost the state by just under 23,000 votes, and also lost Michigan and Pennsylvania by small margins. Those states together were the Electoral College margin that gave President Trump the White House, even as he lost the national popular vote. So I think the focus here coming to Wisconsin is a message about Wisconsin specifically, because we are a very closely matched state between Democrats and Republicans last time, but also a signal to surrounding Midwest and in upper northern industrial states that the party is well aware that our region has been a base for them for decades, and the message of 2016 that the area might move away from the party is something the party is ready to address by having the convention here.
And Hillary Clinton has said she is not running for president, but Politico is reporting today that she's doing a fundraiser for the DNC in Washington later this month, and it's a dinner with Clinton and Chairman Tom Perez. So she is out there helping raise money for the DNC.
No, she certainly is, and she remains an important figure within the party. But I think and it bears mentioning that Clinton was scheduled to campaign in Wisconsin with then-President Obama. That trip was canceled because of the nightclub shooting in Florida the weekend before. But the trip was never rescheduled here. And the Clinton campaign put more emphasis on trying to win some states like Arizona that have been a bit of a stretch for Democrats but seem to be moving in their direction. If you look at the other two states this time, Miami would have been in Florida, a swing state for a long time, and the other option in Houston would have signaled Democrats' intent to stretch to win Texas, a state they haven't won for a long time. Instead, choosing here, I think they reflect the very closeness of the last election and that this upper Midwest region is critically important for them.
Talking with Charles Franklin, he's director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy, talking about the news we learned this week that Milwaukee landed the Democratic National Convention in July of 2020. What do you think about that? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Charles, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Craig Gilbert wrote that, quote, Wisconsin is a microcosm of the fierce political battle for America's suburbs. What do you make of that?
I think it in the last two elections have clearly shown that the suburbs around Milwaukee are some of the very reddest, most Republican suburbs in the country. But if you look at the vote there, Trump in 16 did less well in those counties than Romney had done 4 years earlier. And this year, former Governor Walker did less well in those same counties than he did 4 years ago in 2014. It doesn't mean those counties are inevitably moving away from the GOP, but the evidence is clear that they're no longer delivering the size of margin that they were delivering in 2012 and before. That's an important trend here, but it reflects a trend that we see in suburbs in Georgia and in Texas and in other areas of the country as well. So that's an opportunity for Democrats to improve their margins there. Now, whether the convention itself is going to change anyone's mind, I rather doubt, but I think the focus on it and the opportunity for candidates to launch their national campaign will certainly give some prominence to them here.
I was going to ask you, how important are these conventions? Is it more about the pomp and circumstance, or is it real issues and a platform and an ability to get voters energized?
Yeah, there's usually a bit of a bounce in the polls right after the convention, so that it implies it's generally good for parties. I think the main thing is it gives several days where attention is focused on that party, its candidates, and platform. And then we move on, and then the next convention comes, and there's the same focus on the other party. But it does give a few days of fairly focused attention, and of course culminates on the kickoff speech on the last night when the presidential nominee gets to take center stage for to say what they want to say.
What does Milwaukee need to do between now and July 2020 to get ready here?
Well, I'm sure there's tremendous logistical things to do that. You know, the number of hotel rooms has been talked about as an issue. Do we have enough rooms to accommodate all the people coming in? There's no question in past conventions, no matter how big the city, the convention, not just the delegates, but all of the people surrounding it in the press corps and other party supporters and so on, will often spread out. So I imagine we will have people at the convention staying as far away as Madison and Chicago and perhaps Green Bay. And then there will be that lovely rush hour effect of the normal business of the city plus the convention. So I suspect that will be a little bit tedious for people.
Charles, thank you for ending on a dose of reality. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He's a professor of law and public policy. Coming up, plans show Foxconn using an area of Racine County, Wisconsin, to produce LCD screens. But some analysts speculate that Mount Pleasant could wind up with a smaller operation. We'll look into that. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. plans show Foxconn is using an area of Racine County for a Generation 6 facility. That's industry speak for a plant that produces LCD screens for phones, tablets, and small televisions. Originally, Foxconn planned a Generation 10.5, which is an even bigger plant that produces screens for large LCD TVs. Now, some analysts speculate that Mount Pleasant could wind up with an even smaller operation. Willie Shee is a professor of management at Harvard Business School, and he recently wrote a piece about Foxconn for WisConText. And here he is with WPR's Judith Sears-Poisson.
Can you give us a little more detail about the difference between a Generation 10.5 and a Generation 6 facility? How big a downsize is that?
Well, when you're making these LCDs, usually what people refer to is the mother glass size, and that's what Generation 10.5 versus Generation 6 is. Generation 10.5 is the largest factory that you will find of that type, and typically the size of that glass is such that you can cut, I think it's like 6 75-inch TVs from one piece. So that piece of glass is probably about the size of a parking space, maybe, you know, a little smaller than a one-car garage. Now, a Gen 6 piece of glass is considerably smaller. It's more like the size of maybe a queen-size bed or so. So it's considerably smaller. In both cases, the sheets of glass are very thin, typically 7/10 of a millimeter thick. So you can imagine like a Gen 10.5 sheet of glass that's the size of, a parking space or a one-car garage, and you try to handle that, and it's really quite challenging. So the smaller size glasses are actually much easier to manufacture with.
So were you surprised at all when the company announced that it was scaling its plans back?
Well, actually, no, I was not surprised at all. The first thing is, because when you build a Gen 10.5 fab, as they call them, these factories are called fabs, you have to have that glass come in from a supplier. And Gen 10.5 glass, as you can imagine, is so big and so fragile. Every other 10.5 fab in the world has a glass factory across the street. Okay, and usually what they'll do is they'll feed it via underground tunnels into, you know, the actual LCD factory. You can't ship them. They're so big and they're so fragile. So, you know, once I understood that Wisconsin was not going to provide a subsidy for the construction of the glass factory, you know, I figured it was only a matter of time until, you know, that fab got scaled down. Because, you know, Gen 6 glass, you could ship it from a distance. It's not ideal, but you could ship it. But 10.5 is really not practical.
I think I'm remembering from your article that the closest glass factory, the closest Corning factory that would be making this type of glass is actually in Kentucky. And so you're saying that it's impossible to ship something so sensitive from Kentucky. Usually it's right across the street, as you said.
Well, yeah, Kentucky is not exactly across the street. You could ship Gen 6 glass. I imagine you could, you know, it might take some superhuman efforts to ship Gen 10.5 glass. You know, normally what you have to do is you have to pack it in crates, and it's very fragile. 10.5 is really impractical to ship great distances, but Gen 6 you could.
So you have spent quite a bit of time in China looking at the factories that they have there, the fabs, as you call them, and the glass factories. Give us a sense of the scale of these facilities and whether that would ever have been possible in Wisconsin.
Well, it's possible. If you walk into one of these LCD fabs, I visited a Gen 10.5 fab last year. It was a brand new one in Hefei, China, which is, you know, an inland city. And the building for this fab was 1.3 kilometers from end to end. And usually these fabs are, they're gigantic. And one of the reasons is they have to be an ultra-clean environment. You can imagine if you're trying to make these screens, if you have dust particles get in the way, you know, you'll have like these dark spots on the screen, right? Dead pixels that are referred to. You'll have these monstrous tools that handle everything, robots that move the glass around. You won't see a lot of people on the floor, right? The the people will be engineers who set up the tools, and then we'll be operating on them from a control room off to the side somewhere.
We're talking with Willie Shi right now. He is a professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard University. We're talking about a recent piece that he wrote for wiscontext.org about Foxconn and the differences in doing business in China and Wisconsin and the U.S. And Willie, so it's pretty clear we're not going to have a 10.5 factory here. How confident are you that we will actually get the Generation 6 factory in Mount Pleasant?
Well, that one is possible, okay? It's possible, but Foxconn will face a number of obstacles, okay? First of all, not only the glass, but all the other materials it uses for making LCD panels, whether it's for TV sets or smartphones or whatever, all those other materials have to come from Asia as well, right? So you could say, well, I'm going to build a Gen 6 fab here. I'll import all those materials. But when you are done with the output, you'll have these panels. That's what they call these kind of semi-finished LCD screens, panels which I might use in TVs or use in phones or tablets or whatever. Those panels will then have to go into a product like a TV set or a phone, but the comparison products will come from Asia, will be finished panels, okay, and they will be at a market price, right? So this fab, if Foxconn builds it in Wisconsin, they have to have it at a competitive world market price, right? These panels are kind of a commodity. I hate to say it, right, but they're a commodity, a very high-tech commodity. But the pricing is governed by what other suppliers around the world are willing to sell them for. And we're at a point in the cycle where in China, manufacturers have added a huge amount of capacity, right? So there's really surplus capacity in the market right now, and the pricing isn't very good, right? So you end up with a commodity. So if Foxconn builds this factory and they're selling into a market that has kind of this commoditization pressure, the question will be, how much money can they really make? I've kind of held the position of, well, you don't want to build a fab kind of in the wrong part of the cycle where all you're going to do is add to the glut in the marketplace. You know, that's not good for Foxconn, and it won't be good for Wisconsin if they do that. The core question is, how competitive will that factory be when they're done? I think there's been a level of expectation set about, well, we're going to have an LCD fab, okay? Well, maybe it won't be a Gen 10.5 fab. Maybe it'll be a Gen 6 or Gen 6.5 fab, but we want to have an LCD fab. I don't know if that's necessarily the best approach, right? I mean, because if you think about it, the state of Wisconsin gave Foxconn incentives to really create economic activity, create jobs, and new economic growth there. Okay, now, people have gotten locked into this idea of, you know, you promised a fab, I want to have a fab. Okay, and now Foxconn is trying to kind of figure out how are we going to do this, right? And, you know, if it were a choice of a Gen 6 or 6.5 fab versus something else that might be more economically successful, which would you rather have? I know what I would recommend, but I think that's the core question facing all the stakeholders in this at this point.
Governor Evers' administration, which of course was not the administration that negotiated the contract, that was the previous administration under Scott Walker. The current administration says that they're comfortable with Foxconn's plans for Wisconsin and believe that they're proceeding as they should. And they have also said that they think Foxconn executives are comfortable with their team. How much more complicated is this project, though, with a new administration from a different political party stepping in midstream?
Well, it's always complicated when you have expectations, right? I mean, I think there's a level of expectation set around incentives and what kind of jobs and economic activity will Foxconn create. If that's the objective, do we have to do it with a Gen 6 or Gen 6.5 fab, right? I mean, that's always already a step back from the original promise. Now the question, I think, with a change of administration is how much flexibility is there on both sides? Can both sides come up with something that makes sense and is sustainable economically? You don't want Foxconn to build a factory that loses money, right? Because that doesn't serve anybody well over the long term, right? You actually want Foxconn to do something there that's, you know, going to have a long life and create long-lasting jobs and create that economic activity. So I don't know, right? But the question is, how much flexibility will they show?
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Willie, she is a professor of management at Harvard Business School, talking there with WPR's Judith Sears-Poisson. You can read this piece and other coverage at wiscontext.org/Foxconn. Coming up, it's news. Then we're talking about a multi-billion-dollar industry that sends an assortment of pretty much anything straight to your door. We're talking about the allure of the subscription box. And by the way, thank you to the more than 2,400 members who contributed during our spring membership drive. You donated more than $440,000. It is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about subscription boxes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Subscription services allow shoppers to automatically and regularly receive samples or full-size products for a fee, and it seems that shoppers have latched on big time to these curation services. Last year's count, there were close to 7,000 subscription box companies in the world. How many do you currently subscribe to? Why have you decided to go that route to get certain products that you need or want? And do you currently have a monthly box subscription to perhaps Wisconsin products? We're at 800-642-1234. Anna Riley is a reviewer at My Subscription Addiction. That's a website reviewing monthly subscription boxes. Anna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
For people who are new to this trend, can you explain how subscription boxes work?
Yeah, sure. So first I'll say that the subscription box world is very vast, so there are a lot of different nuances here, but the basic idea is that you would sign up for something that would arrive to your door every month, every season, so something on a regular basis. But exactly what that is, or how you receive it and what service is provided can change, just because there are so many different categories. So you could get something like clothing delivered that's been personally styled for you, or you can get ingredients to make meals at home so you don't have to go to the grocery store. Even now there's a new trend towards rental subscriptions where you can sign up and be a member of a program that lets you, they rent anything from designer clothing pieces to really nice pillows for your bedroom month to month, depending on your needs. So it's basically the regularly occurring part is the most consistent piece. And from there, it's really kind of the sky's the limit, it seems.
When did this trend start? When did you start seeing this really to explode in popularity?
So we got started as a website around maybe like 2015 is when things sort of picked up. I remember personally when like Birchbox started, I started having friends who were subscribing to different subscription boxes. Julep was another one that was a nail polish subscription that I remember that I really liked. And at first it felt I mean, even I was a little skeptical, like, oh, is this just sort of a gimmick to, you know, you buy new things every month? But ever since then, it's really grown and evolved, and to the point where there are, you know, thousands of different boxes now, and for many different sort of niche interests, and the way that programs are structured also, I think, is starting to, rather than just being an item that you can get, sort of like if you think about a magazine subscription where you get something every single month, again, sort of morphing into these service-minded companies that really have the customer in mind. So now that there are you know, options to pause things with a lot of subscriptions. So if you do have too many products each month, you can pause something and skip that month, or you can personalize what you're getting so that it really fits your needs. So it's been going for several years now, but it's kind of evolving.
Well, you threw out a couple names there. Julep, you said, for nails. What does Birchbox offer?
So Birchbox is a makeup sample subscription, I should say, sort of a beauty sample subscription. So they have every month, it's amazing, it's only $10. I think one thing that people think about subscription boxes is they have to be, you know, expensive, like $30 or $40. But these are only 10 bucks a month, and they send you top name beauty products. There's hair care, there's skin care, there are cosmetics. And it's all, you can get it tailored towards your needs. So whether that's sort of like my style of makeup or the sort of way my skin is and what my needs are, you can sort of pick and choose what you get for that way. And it, even though they are sample sizes, it's a really cool way to discover new products without having to, you know, wander on the mall and have that sort of like overwhelmed feeling of seeing just how many choices are out there.
And perhaps a little Christmas at your doorstep. You don't know what's inside the box.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. So, I mean, I can't discount the fact that it just feels really good to get a package. It feels really good to get mail, especially this day and age with, like, so many emails and everything's online. It's awesome to some of the boxes you'll know what you're getting ahead of time. But other boxes you can just get a complete surprise, and that's part of the fun.
We're talking with Anna Riley. She's a reviewer at My Subscription Addiction. That's a website created to review monthly subscription boxes. We want to know about what you are ordering. Are you a subscription box household? How many do you currently subscribe to and why? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Anna, according to a study done by McKinsey, that's a management consulting firm, it says subscription e-commerce market has grown by more than 100% over the past 5 years. So why have we seen this trend really take off and almost build up like an industry?
So I think it's interesting to me. Like, you, a lot of people, whenever I say, you know, I'm into subscription boxes, this is what I do for a job, they say, well, can't you just buy things online? Can't you just, you know, go shopping for something in a store or at the mall rather than getting something every month? And I think it's a couple things. The first is, as we just mentioned, like, the surprise is just really fun. It's fun to get actual tangible things in the mail. The other piece is that it's, I think sometimes for me personally, I get overwhelmed by the amount of choice that's out there. For instance, like, skincare right now is like this big trend in beauty, but there's so many ingredients and there are so many different brands, and it's hard to really know where to start with some of these things. And a subscription box is almost like, it's as if a good friend has taken your interest in mind and packaged up the things that they think are really best that you really should try and sends it to your door. And that can be the same across a bunch of different categories, whether it's food or snacks or, you know, books. It's really a way to discover new things and shop in a way that's convenient and time-saving, but still really effective and fun.
Let's go to Mike now, joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I have been subscribing to the HelloFresh meals for about the last 3 months, and we got hooked because our niece sent us the three free ones to kind of get us going. But we really enjoyed making food together and making food that we typically wouldn't make, like couscous and polenta and just unique things like that. And we also have enjoyed that anticipation of waiting for the gift, quote-unquote gift, to show up to kind of surprise us with new and interesting things. So we've enjoyed it, and it's a little more expensive than maybe what you'd spend in the grocery store, but not much. And once again, that time together and sharing and having some fun cooking has been beneficial.
Mike, do you think you're going to keep this subscription going?
We already have, actually. So and we've said real positive things about it. And once again, we don't do it every night of the week or even every week. And the pausing feature is really nice if we're both traveling or doing things. So that makes it convenient. And so, yeah, I think we'll keep doing it.
Well, Mike, thanks for the call. Anna, it sounds like they're kind of awakening their taste buds, and there's some convenience here.
Oh, yeah. I am a big fan of meal kit subscription boxes. I've tried a whole bunch of them, and they literally taught me how to roast vegetables. That sounds really silly, but I am so much more confident in roasting vegetables for myself now and, like, making simple meals because I had that sort of cooking lesson from these subscription boxes.
What are some of the demographic trends you see here? Are both men and women going for these boxes?
Well, I can say there are boxes for both men and women. I think that women currently are more of the customer base. And I can say specifically that on our site, I know most of our traffic is from women. But there are, again, like some really great men's boxes. We see, especially around the holidays, a lot of I think women shopping the men's boxes as treats for men. I know a lot of men who are, you know, if you're sort of scared of shopping or it's just not even on your radar, but you're, you know, looking for a new set of clothes or you need to refresh your wardrobe for work or something, there are a couple of different subscription boxes like or services like Stitch Fix or Menlo Club will just take your measurements, take your sizing, get a little information about your taste, and then send you a box of clothing or accessories or whatever you're looking for so that you don't have to stay, you know, shopping all day or waste a weekend doing that, but you can still look sharp. And same thing with, like, grooming goods. There are a lot of different razor clubs and things. But I'd say the majority of the people, at least on our site, who are shopping are women, and there are so many amazing boxes for women and, like, all different needs that they might have.
And you have reviewed about 30,000 subscription boxes, your website, perhaps not you personally. But do certain categories like lifestyle or fitness or even beauty have a lot to do with the consumer's decision to choose a certain subscription? You know, what really makes someone, you know, tend to be, gravitate toward a certain type of subscription?
Sure. I mean, I think part of it is just basic, like whatever you're interested in. A lot of the time I recommend to people to really think about whatever problem you want to solve and like who you really are and what you're looking for. So because that's what these boxes are trying to do. So for instance, for me, like I'm someone who ironically for working in the subscription box world, like I don't like having a lot of stuff. You know, I like to find the one or two products that I really, really like and have those around. So for me, like I've really liked services like Fabletics is one that I really love for fitness apparel. I recently joined my city's roller derby team, so I need a lot of really good leggings that will hold on to my body and hold up wash after wash. And so Fabletics works for me in that way. And that's one where I can really like, it's sort of a membership program where I can shop when I want. Skip when I don't want to or I don't need anything. And I know that the quality is there, but I know that I'm also getting a product that for a lot less than I might spend if I was to go into a sporting goods store or something.
Talking subscription boxes on the morning show with Anna Riley as our guide. She's a reviewer at the website at My Subscription Addiction. What is it about these boxes that excite you? Do you enjoy knowing what's coming in the mail each month? Call in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Maybe you're watching your mailbox today for one. We're talking subscription boxes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Netflix, meal kits, beauty products, yoga supplies, dog treats. There are thousands of these curated subscription services. Your experiences are welcome at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite boxes that you subscribe to? How do these products better your everyday life? Talking with Anna Riley. She's our guide. She's a reviewer at My Subscription Addiction. That's a website reviewing monthly subscription boxes. Let's go back to the phones now with Valerie joining us from Mauston. Valerie, hi. Oh, Valerie, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Oh, we're having
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you. Yep, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. So my husband and I love BarkBox, a subscription for our dogs. We get a monthly subscription that includes treats and toys, and we live in a smaller town, so we don't have access to all the shopping options that are available in bigger towns. So it's really nice to get something in the mail that we would have had to travel to get otherwise.
Do you find that you go through and use everything that comes in the box?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. 100% each time we get a box. It's usually gone within a week.
And how long have you been a subscriber?
Over a year with BarkBox.
So your animals, too, probably. Your dogs are anticipating that arrival.
Yes. They love it. The one dog knows when it comes every single time. He stares at it sitting on the counter until we open it for him.
I love it. Have you branched out to any other types of subscription services?
We've tried HelloFresh. We got three meals for free from a friend. And I really did like the meals. It was nice to try something new. One of the other callers mentioned things like couscous and polenta, things that you normally wouldn't try. But I did find that the meal kits were a little more expensive than I was willing to pay. But other than that, they were delicious, and I loved having the food delivered to my front door.
Valerie, thanks so much for the call. Anna, what do you hear there?
Yeah, I think that that's true. Like, there are a bunch of different subscription boxes at different price points and levels. Again, it's sort of like figuring out what works best for you and your budget and your lifestyle, too. I know for me, like, it may not be an every week thing to do something like HelloFresh, but maybe every other week works for me. You just have to, and because of the way the service works, it's easy to kind of like nudge your schedule around and decide when you want to have a box and be charged or not. I know one of the reasons I like meal kits in particular is because I'm already probably spending more than I need to getting takeout and things like that around town. So for someone who's trying to get into the kitchen, get out of the takeout line or the hot food bar, that's when I think it's really definitely helpful.
Let's go to David now, joining us from Oshkosh with a question. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I honestly don't know if you'll know the answer to this question. It's more a logistical end. So I have an idea that I've been wanting to make reality of something like these, a kind of Taste of Wisconsin subscription box, but like as a starter and then move it further along down the line. But how does somebody go about like gathering all these different products from all these different places and putting them into like the same box? You know, these are coming from lots of different vendors, and I mean, do they have one giant warehouse where they hold this?
Hmm. How do you be a startup in this sector, Anna?
Well, I'll admit that I am less familiar with this and how sort of the mysterious back-end world of how all of this works. But I do know that there are a bunch of different networks and websites. There's one called Crate Joy that's a bit of a, like sort of like a marketplace for subscription boxes. There are a lot of different kind of like smaller subscription boxes that run via that platform. There are some others as well where I think to get started, I'm not quite sure how to begin, but I know that that is sort of the secret, right, is finding all of these great sources for things to put into one box. But I can say that I would 100% subscribe to a Taste of Wisconsin box because I have family there, and I love everything Wisconsin.
All right, David.
Find me a way to get cheese curds here, and I'll do it.
David, you have to have the big reveal here. What would you put in your box?
Well, you had mentioned cheese right away. That's got to go in there. But there's great sausage makers, wine makers, maple syrups, honeys, olive oils, all sorts of different things, really. But non-perishable things. That's my biggest problem with HelloFresh is the perishable end of stuff and those types of things. Tomatoes. I need to touch that stuff to get it.
Yeah, that can get really tricky in transport, mm-hmm. and that's a whole new level of supply chain management that I don't know if David wants to tackle or many others who want to start one of these things. So, you know, we hear about the Marie Kondo lifestyle. It's gained popularity, which mm-hmm. explains the benefits of decluttering your life, getting rid of all the unnecessary items. Is this mindset pushing back on this industry at all?
So I think that, again, there are some boxes that will be for the people who love shopping, love collecting things. There are boxes for that crowd. There are also services for, like I said, like I'm not really a stuff person, but I still find the value in a lot of different boxes. So maybe that includes a lot of these new rental programs. For instance, like a lot of people have heard of Rent the Runway, mm-hmm. and that's a service where you can, if it's maybe over a weekend or if it's for a whole month, depending on your needs, you can rent sort of higher end, nicer clothing that ranges from nice jeans to office attire to wedding dresses and everything in between for a set monthly price. So that would let you, and there are some other companies that have just started that too. American Eagle actually is one that just started a renting or a rental service where you can hop in there, have that same feeling of shopping for something new. Everything comes to you like new and looks fantastic. But then when you're done with it, you just, you know, fold it up, put it in a box and return it to the company and pick something else. Which means that those things aren't sitting in your closet, but you still get that feeling of shopping for something new and having something new and trendy and cool. Even if you only wear it once, that's totally fine.
Let's bring in Jessica now from Milwaukee. Jessica, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on subscription boxes?
So I've done a couple different ones, HelloFresh, Fitbox. And I was wondering if there's potentially going to be a trend of making these boxes less wasteful because there's so much extra packaging. That was one of the first things I noticed. I was like, seriously, we have a bag for this, this, and this? And I get, like, why it's cool, everything's portioned out. But do you think there's going to be a trend to make these boxes a little bit less package-heavy and a little bit more sustainable?
Great question, Jessica. Where do you see that happening, Anna?
Yeah, this is important to me, too. I have seen more, especially with the food boxes, they're trying to, over time, I've seen them kind of like slim down all of the different packaging that's in their boxes. A lot of it is recyclable, and there's, you'll see on certain boxes, their websites, they'll tend to have statements on like, here's how to take care of the materials in your box and how to throw them away responsibly. On a smaller scale, I think that there are more and more boxes that I'm seeing with more sustainable packaging. So maybe just a beauty box with like a simple cardboard box. There's a really awesome subscription service called Boxwalla. They have a couple different subscriptions. One is, I think, food. There's one for books. There's one for beauty. And they actually deliver their items in this really pretty box that's made, I believe, from recycled cotton. And it's handmade. It's, you know, made from or by it's handmade by hand from people, artisans in India, I think. And ethically. So all of those concerns, I think, are starting to circulate more throughout the industry. And so my fingers are really crossed, too, because I know that is one thing that holds a lot of people back is just what to do with all that packaging.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, for sure. This was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Anna Riley is a reviewer at My Subscription Addiction. That's a website created to review monthly subscription boxes. Just ahead, William Proxmire was Wisconsin's longest-serving senator. We look at his new biography. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.